Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here with Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Ian Hislop. We are in the Private Eye office and this is a special edition of Page 94 because if you listen to the last episode, you will have heard us put out a call for correspondence. We have had an email address all this time. We just hadn't told any of you. It's podcast@private-eye.co.uk. Last time we asked if you had any questions, and this time we are going to do a postbag special. So I thought we'd start off with one from Nick Barber. Nick writes, "Welcome to the 21st century with your email address." All right, sarcasm to start.
Calling it a postbag special, though. When was the last time you saw a postbag?
Yeah, we'll answer the questions in about 3 weeks.
It's a great point. I've always wondered why Private Eye doesn't have bylines. Obviously, some contributors do so for safety, but investigative journalists at other institutions do include their names. So why not the Eye? Not that I necessarily want them, just wondering.
Well, it's very simple. If you give reporters bylines, they get a certain amount of credit for the stories. Whereas if you don't give them a byline, then it's just you as editor, and you say, it's all down to me. And that's been the guiding principle.
There you go. Hope that answers your question, Nick.
I quite like writing without a byline in Private Eye, because I obviously do write under my own byline elsewhere. But I don't know if you've ever spotted this, Andy, but you do get an awful lot of grief sometimes with things that you write. And sometimes, like, just submerging yourself into the kind of gestalt consciousness of Private Eye is quite relaxing.
What she means is being able to say, oh, no, I think that must be one of Andy's, actually. Yeah, no, sorry, mate.
I mean, definitely, there is a level of plausible deniability in the book reviews. We're like, that was a very mean book review, wasn't it? Oh, we could have written that.
I like it. I mean, apart from the fact that I'm completely invisible after 27 years in journalism, but it takes out
you
a lot of...
again?
I'm Andy Murray.
Oh, right. Yes, I like him.
It's very good, isn't it? Yes. It takes away a lot of ego and infighting, which is a lot of the stuff I find myself writing about in Street of Shame and all that byline banditry and stuff, that you can just you go in. And there is a sort of Private Eye voice that you take on as well.
Yes.
Which is different for different sections as well. I mean, the tone of the book reviews is different to, you know, the Street of Shame stuff is different again to the In the Back stuff. But it does allow you that sort of sarcasm and all the catchphrases and the... and continued page 94s and all those things you can kind of throw in.
As editor, one of the things you learn over the years is people who say, look, I don't want anyone to know that I write for Private Eye. And then everyone you know says, oh, I was at a dinner party. He was telling me how brilliant his latest piece was. So there's a certain outing of yourself that goes on. But if you don't want to, and you literally want to work from inside your field without anyone knowing it, that is possible through not using a byline. And people say, well, it means you're not accountable or transparent or responsible. You are. It's just all the shit comes one way and it's not to the writer.
There was someone who, just on the outing oneself subject, it was a very long piece as well. It was kind of a sort of special section. It was someone teaching. It was someone at a school who was writing about their
experience. The teacher.
And it was great. And I think it was a he, was quite secret.
He was.
I handled that. I kind of edited that supplement. It was a four-page pull-out thing. It was a diary
really
of a teacher
good.
In a comprehensive school. It was really, really, really well written. But he was so paranoid about his identity coming out. We had to do everything through sort of burner phones and kind of anonymous emails and all sorts of things. And the second it was published, after we'd taken all of this care over it, he just couldn't resist. He was like, it was me. And immediately got sacked from his job.
I was going to say, the other thing about Private Eye being largely anonymous is the fact it adds a certain glamour to it, right? I always used to think of it like being Willy Wonka. Because chocolate factory, like no one ever goes in, no one ever comes out. And we are just the little Oompa Loompas toiling away in obscurity. But I should say, it also means sometimes people can pretend to work for Private Eye. Quite famously, Heather Mills McCartney, as she was then, tried to confuse herself with our Heather Mills and pass herself off as an investigative journalist. So,
yeah. And particularly at local level, you often get people writing and saying, I had a call from one of your journalists. And I say, any indication who? Because I've never heard of them. So there's a certain amount of that goes on. But I think on the whole, the system works. And then the pay is sort of Oompa Loompa level.
All the chocolate you can eat. Drink from the river. On a historical note, there were originally, not quite bylines, but there was a staff list at the front of every edition. And the real reason that disappeared was because in 1967, off the top of my head, Randolph Churchill, son of Winston, sued the Eye and sued personally everyone who was listed on that staff list. We got the writ and a frame downstairs. The weird thing is a lot of them, they were listed by like their sort of in-office nicknames and things. So this very, very formal legal document arrived addressed to people who didn't really exist. But that was the reason at that point was, I think, legal advice was taken that it was a very bad idea that people could be sued personally. And so from that point on, everything has been anonymous.
Okay, next up, Rory McClellan writes, I've been a subscriber for almost 2 decades now. Thank you, Rory. Magazine's available, private-eye.co.uk. Just putting it in there. And have lost count of the times the Eye has reported a big story that takes years to filter through into the newspapers. Why are stories the Eye reports on often ignored by the rest of the media for so long? Do none of them read the mag? Best wishes, Rory. It's nice, isn't it?
They definitely do read the mag, because they're quite quick to complain when we write about them in the Street of Shame pages. I can say that.
I think it's just because the Eye has an ability to repeat. That's when people notice that we've gone on and on and on about this, and finally it breaks or it turns up elsewhere. I mean, the truth is everybody picks which stories they run, and a lot of other institutions don't want to run this type of story, so they don't. And it's that simple. Why don't they pick up on it? Because they don't want to. That's it.
Also, it's a downside of doing original reporting, isn't it, rather than commentary, which is if you've done original reporting that's based on a key source that only you know who they are, or documents that only you've got access to, it's quite a big punt as another news organisation to follow that up without having the same level of legal security of that source or that document. Mm. So I think sometimes the Eye is, you know, hampered by the fact its own brand of actually doing the legwork. You know, if something is absolutely public and everybody can have an opinion on it, then one, people write that up, and you know, and that stuff gets just followed up everywhere. But actually, when you're doing legally risky stuff, it's harder to get it followed up for that reason.
And it's a naturally journalistic thing as well, which applies here as well, that we won't follow up a story that's been run elsewhere unless there is something significant that we can add to it. So, I mean, news desks, you're going to face that problem. If someone says, I've read this brilliant story in Private Eye, it's like, well, okay, it has been done in Private Eye. How do we move it on? As you say, if we've got the whistleblowers, we've got the context. It's there. I mean, I have had a few times over the years I've been working here, people from national papers phone me up and say, look, I'd really like to do something on this story. Is there anyone you can pass on to me? And the best I can say in that situation is I will tell the person that I've been talking to that you're interested. I can pass on your contact details. But obviously, you know, people come to us. Anonymity is the most important part of it, and protecting our contacts. So there is a sort of logistical difficulty as well to following these things up, as you say.
But also the people who write commentary and opinion in other papers often don't want that particular story. I mean, the reason the Post Office story did not get taken up for a very long time is because of the government and the Post Office and Horizon span really hard. And they wrote aggressive letters the second you followed up anything that originally Computer Weekly or then that we had written. And people then shied away from it. And so nobody wanted to say, isn't this a scandal, when they had, you know, a barrage of abusive and threatening letters coming their way from particularly, you know, with establishment papers, government sources attached to them. You know, and we're in the middle of a row about what Kemi Badenoch did and or didn't say. And all I can say at this point is they haven't got a very good record on telling the truth, have they? And we get a very, very, you know, sort of sniffy letter from Kevin Hollenrake MP, who's supposedly in charge of the Post Office at the moment, saying, well, that picture you ran of me a long time ago at a Fujitsu fundraising table, look, there's not a conspiracy. And then today he says, yeah, when the bloke was fired, I wasn't actually on the call, so I don't know what happened. You're the, what is it, Minister for the Post Office, it says here on your letter. So there is a problem in following these stories when the pushback is so hard from government and those involved.
But also I think there's the fact that stories sometimes only catch fire when they're part of a narrative or being pushed by a particular campaign group or as part of a partisan political row. So the worst mass shooting in American history was the Las Vegas shooting. But it doesn't mean anything, if you see what I mean. It was just a terrible tragedy. It wasn't a white nationalist. It wasn't an Islamist. It was just a man who was mentally ill, had a grudge and a lot of guns. And so it doesn't really get remembered in the way that lots of other terrorist atrocities do. And there's a similar thing happened with the Panama Papers, which were the documents about tax evasion and tax avoidance. And David Cameron's father had an offshore trust. And this was reported at the time and then reheated during the Brexit campaign, when suddenly everyone kind of fell about going, this is terrible, David Cameron's father involved in offshore trusts. And it was because at that point he wasn't Tory leader, he was leader of the Remain campaign. And it had obviously been briefed against the leader of the Remain campaign. And so I think the Post Office story is a classic example of this. Everyone came out of it badly. It wasn't like Labour could go, ah, oh, the terrible Tories, because you were like, and who set up the contract with Fujitsu in the first place? It rhymes with Schmue Schmaber. And I think that's something that as well that really stops stories getting followed up, is if they don't help anyone's agenda to advance them, then they can just be a terrible thing that happened.
Yes. Or just wrong, or an offence to national justice. All right.
Any of those old-fashioned ideas, yes.
Well, here's a good follow-up, which is about the long-running stories that the Eye does. It's kind of related. So this is from Chris Brown. Who decides what stories to pursue doggedly for decades, Post Office, Teasworks, and why? Is it the experienced journalistic judgment or preconception of the editor, the enthusiasm or sources of the journalist, or something else?
Good question. But all of those.
Yeah.
And, I mean, as editor, I freely take any amount of credit. But also, I will admit there are times in any long-running campaign where the piece comes in and I say, oh, God, is it this again?
We've never had this acknowledged before. This is good to know.
And then the journalist correctly then says, yes, you do have to run this again, A, because I've written it, and B, because it's important. And then I say, I'm only trying to reflect the limited attention span of our readers and try and protect that, which, again, is a very unconvincing argument if you're the journalist who's just written it. So on the whole, yes, it's a mixture of those things. And we have the amazing luxury of being able to repeat because there's so much else in the news pages and there are the jokes. And as I explained to an American PhD student, the Eye operates on the principle of Mary Poppins, the leading philosopher, the spoonful of sugar, helping the medicine go down. And I hope that is now in the vaults of a very big American university.
I think of it as a bit like a loaf of bread. You know, the outer edge, you've got the crust, which is sometimes a little harder to get through, but I think is better for you. And on the absolute inside, you've got the very softest bit of the loaf, which is the most fun to eat, but doesn't contain as much of the, you know, the really difficult, nutritious stuff. Everyone, I'm getting three blank faces.
No,
spoonful of sugar, loaf of bread. Listeners, what foodstuff do you think Private Eye most resembles?
I think it's salted caramel.
Okay.
Everything is better with it. You can't have too much of one. Things that are one note are bad, right? Mm. So actually, everything has to have some balance to it. So come on, Adam. You're the only one who hasn't thought of a food that we are.
A potato. Reliable, starchy, and a mainstay of nutrition.
And about to get mashed.
So podcast@private-eye.co.uk. Tell us which food you think the Eye is most like, and we'll maybe cover some of them in the next few episodes. Here is a really difficult one. Now, I don't think you've seen all these questions, or I hope you haven't, but William Nash writes, hello, love the podcast. Thank you, William. I love Private Eye, but sometimes it's also bleak. I have to tune out to save myself. Can you tell me one thing you like about the British political establishment and one thing the bloody Tories have done well in the last 14 years? Yours positively, William.
I can go with one thing the Tory government, or it was the coalition government at the time, have done, which I personally benefited from, which was equal marriage.
There we go.
And that's why my list stops.
But I think that's quite a good one, because Cameron said of gay marriage, I support it not in spite of being a conservative, but because of being a conservative. So he found a way to work equal rights into an absolutely, you know, into a right-wing story that was about family and being grounded in a community and all of those kind of traditionally conservative values. I think that was genuinely groundbreaking. If you look across at America, you know, I think where the LGBT picture is much more polarised, what has happened in Britain over that has been genuinely very good. I'm going to row in behind you on that one.
Absolute sea change in attitudes that just extraordinarily quick. And then afterwards, you know, you've got a generation, not even just a younger generation, but a generation above it as well. They're just going, well, what was all that about? We just, you know, in terms of social attitudes, we just moved on. And that was something you have to give Cameron credit for, that he spotted that. And
I go to those cranky conservative conferences where, you know, still abortion is still a huge culture war issue, but just, yeah, gay rights is just not, it's just not somewhere that they even go, actually, at all. There's just no, there are no votes in being homophobic. I'm going to say the passport office, which is slightly less important than equal rights for gay people, but nonetheless, it has been a quiet success story. It was an absolute shambles during the pandemic, and now, actually, you can get a passport quite quickly.
That's great.
And they should tell everyone else in Whitehall what the magic was that they did.
I didn't know that.
Mm, that's interesting. Well, again, as the correspondent notes, those things don't get reported on. Passport office in a shamble, no one can go on half-term holiday, is a story. Passport office working as intended.
Yes, it is oddly harder to see.
I think there have been, actually, I mean, I know we've reported a lot on waste in government IT projects and things, but there are a few things that actually quietly, digitally work really, really well now. Things like renewing your car tax and that sort of thing that you can just do online. Like, astonishingly efficient. And I don't know where those may be long-term projects. I couldn't date you when that sort of stuff. But little tweaks like that have gone on in the background that I think have made things better.
Gov.uk is actually a very useful website. Like, doing your tax return here compared to doing an American tax return is, like, almost kind of getting a present from God itself. So there are
things... I mean, it kind of has to be better digitally because you cannot get through to anyone at HMRC on the phone.
There's the proper
get any
tone.
Advice from anyone. But.
People are very, very keen that I should at some point say, well, apart from these rude stories we've written about the government, they're marvellous in the following ways. And I try not to do that because when the government changes, I'll have the next lot in. But I'll all say, well, you never said that at the time. So... I mean, once or twice I'm persuaded by people to put in a good news corner where something happens that isn't absolutely terrible or isn't quite as bad as it could have been. But on the whole, we are a satirical magazine and an investigative and campaigning journal, and we're not running upbeat stories. And that is the nature of the beast. And the reason that a lot of readers have pointed this out, they read those bits and there are 50 cartoons. And those are all good news in their way.
Yeah. No one ever wrote to Jonathan Swift saying, I really like book two of Gulliver's Travels, but I just wonder the next one. Can it be a bit more cheerful?
And it's a bit bleak, isn't it? Isn't it, John?
Yeah. Well, my thing the Tories have done well, austerity. I just thought it was a really well thought out and worked really well. Okay, here's an interesting one, and it's from Ben. Ben writes, hi team, can you help me understand something, please? Some of the polling, commentators and podcasts have been predicting the collapse of the Tory party. Massive drop in MPs, donors leave, potentially not the official opposition. It could be that the party drifts into insignificance by 2030. My question is, what happens when there is less than 10% of the Commons as Conservative, but a ton of Tory peers in the Lords? This question has come up after the recent rushed peerage of Baron David, which I presume is David Cameron. I don't know the answer to that one. I think that's...
I don't think it'll happen. I don't think it'll happen for two reasons. I don't think the Tory vote will go, seat number will go that low. I can't see anyone else coming in to be an official opposition, getting more seats than the Tories, however bad things are. I do think things are going to be very, very bad for them. But the other thing is that Labour have already pledged that they're going to do some form of Lords reform, which everyone always says, and then they sort of bottle out actually doing it in the end. But, I mean, in that situation, the pressure to do something about the Lords for precisely those reasons that the listener said would be, you know, pretty, you know, unchallengeable, wouldn't it?
There are lots of complaints about the fact that the Conservatives under this government, this term, have had that the Lords have been stroppy and have delayed things that they wanted done. And one of the reasons, I think, I can't remember who I was in an interview, said this to me, in previous Tory governments, like pre-Blair, there were so many more hereditaries who were, you will not be surprised to discover, largely quite conservative rather than being avid socialists. So that, you know, the government had a lot easier time in the Lords. It was used to having even, you know, an even weightier stack. So I think there would be a huge feeling this was anti-democratic to have a Lords that was opposed to the Commons and was blocking things. However, I will say about the total collapse of the Tory party, actually what's kind of historically unusual is that the parties have been static for so long. You don't hear a lot about the Whigs these days, do you, Andy? And more's the pity. And indeed, the Liberal Party was one of the dominant parties at the turn of the 19th century and collapsed, declined and folded into the Liberal Democrats eventually. What's quite interesting about the Tory party is that it has survived for so long in so many different ideological guises, right?
It's in the last 3 years.
So although I agree with Adam, even the worst rates of what the polling look like don't look like essentially a disappearance of the Tory party. It's quite unusual that they have, you know, you end up with that duopoly as it has been since the 60s now, at least.
All right, there you go, Ben. Don't worry about it. It won't happen.
It's fine.
No, I wouldn't worry about it. What happens if there's a very large reform presence and they say, well, it's time we had 30% of the upper chamber reflecting our views? And then presumably the next stage of Lords reform, you would have, I don't know, Lord Lawrence Fox and Lord... who else do we have? Lord Dan Wootton. These are the Lords that I'm looking forward to. Lord Tice, obviously. and presumably Speaker of the Lords, Lord Farage. I mean, again, I'm putting this largely to give people nightmares, but also as you say, well, they'll reform it when that happens. It sort of depends what the vote is, doesn't it?
I'm going to air my unpopular opinion here, which is that if Reform are polling that high, they deserve some representation in the Commons. I mean, this has always been the argument against proportional representation.
In the Lords, you're saying?
Well, I mean, anywhere, whether that be, and you know, but the fact is that the first past the post is very hostile to new entrants, and there clearly are a lot of people who support something to the right of the Tory party in a number of ways. It's kind of unpleasant to think that you might get BNP-style parties, English National Party, those kind of parties represented in the Commons. But it's kind of unpleasant to think that some people want to vote for them. And we have got a system that locks out new entrants. And the question is, when it comes to a more right-wing party than I personally would vote for, but not an illegitimately right-wing one, you know, not a violently right-wing one, should Reform... I'm just saying, I like the idea of Lorne Dunwoodton, and here is my campaign to make it happen, Ian. It's starting here.
Good. Well, the next question, oddly, is do journalists ever get fired? And yes, indeed, Anonymous, they do.
Here's quite a nice one about process. This is from Simon Lundy. A question about courts and disclosures. And this is actually related to what we spoke about last time. We were speaking about the various rules about what you can and can't say in open court and what you can and can't report. I understand the points made re criminal cases, reporting, etc., but there was a mention of super injunctions and D-notices, but no further comment or explanation. And a D-notice is a national security restriction on what you can report, isn't it? Effectively.
It is.
It's a sort of very, like, top government level, you can't say this. My question is, how does a journalist know that there is a super injunction or a D notice? If someone gives the journalist a tip to follow up, how can the journalist ensure that they do not breach either of those things? Which is a really good question that you might want to know. How on earth do you know? You get a story, you write it up?
With some difficulty, from our point of view, certainly. Right. So we have mentioned, we did go into a bit more detail on this in a previous podcast, but super injunctions essentially are, as far as we know, and I'm pretty certain on this, a thing of the past now since that review by the Master of the Rolls in 2011. After there were loads and loads of them, it was decided that by Master of the Rolls, top of the legal system, reviewed it, said this is an untenable situation. I mean, super injunctions are different to normal injunctions, which are a fairly standard part of law. Injunctions saying there are elements of this that have been decided in court cannot be reported. Super injunctions, you're not allowed to say that the injunction exists, which was just extraordinary, and leads into exactly what the listener's asking about. That if you don't know that something exists, how do you know not to breach it? And I had to do at that time, sort of 2010, 2011, an awful lot of research and phoning around contacts on newspapers and lawyers and saying, right, what ones do you know about? Can we compare notes on this? And we've got a file. I think we've still got it next door of all of them and as many as we could identify at that point. Partly just for research purposes and wanting to know how many of them there were, because we wanted to write about them as a kind of concept, but also for those very reasons that you don't want to end up breaching them without realizing it.
Okay, what about D notices?
So D notices don't exist anymore. I thought they'd been replaced by DA notices. I now find out this morning they are now something called DSMA notices, which are issued by the Defence and Security Media Advisory Committee. Now, these are not desperately secretive because you can find out all about them by going to dsma.uk, where you will discover that there are essentially a load of standing DSMA notices, which are just aimed... They're aimed at essentially not giving away anything that will be useful to terrorists or enemies of the state. So it's basically, if you have found that there is some terrible vulnerability in our nuclear power stations, not publishing exactly how to blow them up, that sort of thing. And there are five standing DSMA notices which cover, well, list them out for your military operations plans and capabilities. So that's basically saying, not printing a piece saying we're going to attack the Houthis tomorrow from this place, and that's where they'll be launching the drones. Nuclear and non-nuclear weapons systems and equipment, military counter-terrorist forces, special forces and intelligence agency operations, physical property and assets, so that's, you know, the nuclear power stations and things I was talking about, and personnel and their families who work in sensitive positions. So that's basically not going, hey, see that guy in Tehran? He's actually a spy, and his kids go to this school. So, I mean, there's stuff that you... There is a fairly obvious reason for you know, it's actually putting people in danger, including potentially yourself in this situation.
That did come up this week when the Keir Starmer biography came out, because his chief of staff, Sue Gray, spent some of the 80s running a pub along the Irish border, which people said, that's a very strange thing to do. Some might say the kind of thing that a spy would do. And Sue Gray gave an on-the-record denial for the first time, saying, no, I wasn't a spy. And then someone pointed out that under British law, if you are a spy, you are obliged to go, no, I wasn't a spy. So it doesn't really get us any further along knowing whether or not that was true. But that's not exactly a D-notice, is it, Adam? That's just a sort of standing MI6 rule that you don't out spies? Or
that would be the Official Secrets Act, wouldn't it?
Ah, okay.
I would guess.
I mean, I'm glad to hear that it's been automated now, because in the old days, the D-notice committee was rather more informal. It was more gentlemanly, and I had personal experience of this, because I don't know if you remember, during one of the Iraq wars, there were some plans for an operation called Desert Storm, which were in the back of, I think it was a Volvo, which was nicked, and nobody knew where these plans were. And I had a very irate call from the head of the D-notice committee, who was an admiral at the time, saying, is that Ian Hislop? And I said, yes, it is. And he said, you know these plans for Desert Storm? And I said, yeah. And he said, you don't know where they are, old boy. You know, which is Britain working in a slightly different way.
Yeah, just the chaps phoning up to say, yeah. Got any military secret military plans?
Yes, I said, yeah, I've got them in the back of the office, Adam.
They're stored in the company Volvo, yeah.
It has been slightly more formalised now. I should just to finish off the details of it. What happens if there's an additional DSMA notice on a specific story, which does happen very occasionally, is that it will be issued by email to all editors, I guess this includes you, Ian, and through the Press Association and the Society of Editors networks. That sounds slightly sinister, doesn't it?
Can I check? How far does it go? As in, if I'm working on Railways Today or whatever, you know, is it just national papers? Is it local papers or hobbyists?
It says here all editors. How many of you ever do you remember receiving, Ian?
Very few, largely because people don't consider Private Eye a proper publication or indeed myself as a proper editor. And once I was very, very grateful during a lengthy case against the Maxwell brothers, which it was very useful for us that this system isn't infallible. The late Robert Maxwell, he died at the time. His sons were being tried for possible corruption and various other offences. And Private Eye ran an interview with the late Robert Maxwell from hell, which the judge deemed to be prejudicial to the current case. But fortunately, he went through the records and I didn't get the email.
Oh, there we go. So the next question is, it's sort of semi-related. It's why aren't you writing about this? And I promise there aren't many of these, you know.
But no, which is quite right.
And I'll pick the one from Edward, who writes, my question is about Charlotte Owen, who we did write about in the last issue of the magazine, and maybe the one before that.
Yeah.
Who is she and how come she's in the House of Lords? And if you're not allowed to answer that, why? And if you're not even allowed to talk about her, why? I'd love more answers, because her appointment is infuriating on the face of it, but may have logical reasons.
It'd be quite funny if we just had a single shot run out and then this podcast ended. That would start a few conspiracy theories, wouldn't it?
But so this is Charlotte Owen, who was an aide in Downing Street, seemed to be relatively junior, was then elevated as part of Boris's, I think it was his leaving honours, wasn't it, to the House
along
of
with
Lords.
Ross Kempsall, who's a similar age to her, and no one is quite as cross about.
No, Ross Kempsall, who...
Is he blonde?
He's not, no, he's got...
No, well, you've got no news judgment at all, have you?
I'm so sorry, I'm coming at it from another angle from you.
I mean, my main thing is that his name begins with Ross Kemp. Yes. And no one seems to talk about that nearly enough for me.
I always think Adam's going to talk about Ross Kemp. Ross Kemp's made a beer.
I can talk about Ross Kemp if you want me to.
The hard man of the Lords. No, so lots of people, and again, this is a very big thing online as well, lots of people have lots of sinister theories about Charlotte Owen being in the House of Lords and why she's there.
Basically, people wanted to say that she's either Boris Johnson's daughter or his lover, and there's no evidence that anybody can find for either of them.
No, I can tell you there are a lot of journalists on a lot of publications who've been looking for nefarious reasons behind it, and I think my conclusion on it is that essentially Boris did his resignations list by looking around the office and going, oh, you could be on it. And if you happen to wander through the room, that's sort of quite within character for Boris, you know, as much as elevating lovers and love children to the Lord.
I believe that entirely. But didn't this girl's mother actually issue a statement saying, no, look, she is my child, thank you very much, everybody online. Can you not put this on anymore?
Yeah. Well, it was one of those classic online conspiracy theories that relied on them leaving a really big clue in there, which is called Charlotte Owen, and Boris's first wife is called Allegra Mostyn Owen. But that, if you think about that for a
singular,
second,
yeah.
it just doesn't stand up, would it? I mean, if you're trying to hide your love child, you'd
give her a different name.
Also, it's definitely her mother was someone else. And it's not like if you have a secret love child, you go, I'm going to name this love child after the first wife of the guy I had it with. That's very odd love child behaviour.
The answer to this question, why haven't you run this story, is quite likely to be because it isn't true. That's always a slight problem. And the other one, my other answer is, because we don't know about it, can you tell me? Mm. And if the answer to can you tell me is I read it on some blog somewhere that I can't remember where and the detail's gone, that isn't very useful. So to be honest, the answer to the Charlotte Owen story is nobody knows why Boris appoints her. Maybe he doesn't know. we were at that point of the cycle. It's not because there's a super injunction. Again, the other thing a lot of people write in and say is, you see, I've got this story about my accountant and I'm guessing he's got a super injunction out. And you say, you've guessed wrongly, he hasn't, and give us the detail. Don't assume that it's cowardice or a legal problem. You know, the rare occasions when, you know, there is an order or we can't say anything, like we've twice had to put in, there was going to be a piece about Lucy Letby. There isn't. There is a very, very authoritarian order restraining what we can say. We've challenged it once. It's been slightly ameliorated, but it still makes it very difficult to report about it. You know, and this is because there's another trial coming up. And there's nothing we can do about that. That's not cowardice. That's not, I'm terribly scared. It's, we don't want to mess the trial up.
And that piece will appear at the conclusion of the trial, I would imagine, in form of it, won't it? Yeah.
It's funny. It's probably partly, you know, it sort of relates to Private Eye writers not having bylines, this kind of thing. There is a slightly different feel of pieces in Private Eye, which I think does encourage people to think, that we're probably sitting on a big cache of stories that we haven't published yet. But the truth is, that's not true at all.
If you can stand the story up, it goes in. When you stand the story up and get it past Ian.
But it is kind of a wonderful reflection about the fact we do expect everything to be explicable now. I often think, this is one of my weird delusions, but I often think about what life must have been like as a medieval peasant, right? When you had no idea what was coming around the corner and your crops might fail. We do assume that everything is totally explicable.
As a medieval peasant, it was God.
It was, yeah.
Or you failing God.
Yeah, right. And that was probably, you just live
simpler
with that level
times,
of...
Simpler times,
Helen. We so need to return.
It's just Boris moving in mysterious ways, right. Isn't it?
Helen, you have spent too much time at these conservative conferences that you're...
They long for the simple agrarian society where men were men and wheat fields were wheat fields.
Don't worry, if the popcorns get their way, we will all be tilling the crops before long. Okay, here's a really nice one. This is from Stephen D. Quirk. Thank you, Stephen. There are two questions. The first one is, as a bit of a procedure nerd, I'd love to hear a bit about how it's put together, which items go in first, which are left till last, and then just how close to the Wednesday do we actually send it off? And then secondly, in the 12 years or so of reading the mag, I can't help notice just how many big governmental announcements occur on the Monday just before the new issue. Is this a healthy sign that I'm paying attention to the world, or are tinfoil hats and thinking Lawrence Fox has some good points in my future?
Good letter. I agree about the Monday deadline, though. It's not a Wednesday. We go to press Monday night, and the bulk of people get it the Wednesday, but some people get it on the Tuesday, depending where you are and how the Royal Mail's doing at this particular time. But no, I mean, I think you could assume that people do know when we go to press, and certain people don't answer questions that we need very badly until we've just gone to press, and people play games with us on that. So I think it's fair to assume that happens. The other thing is, what order do things go in? I can't really reveal that because it might give away editorial incompetence and lack of timetabling. So I'm afraid that is under a D notice.
Hey, nice try, Stephen.
The one thing that I did, I read Adam's very good History of Private Eye before coming to work here.
Very good Remainder bookshops, folks.
Yeah, because like the big SWAT I am. And I was surprised that until the pandemic happened, you were essentially sticking things together with bits of Pritt stick.
I'm still a bit unhappy that that's changed. I mean, I used to love the Pritt stick, you know?
Ian wasn't using the Pritt stick. He had a man who used the Pritt stick for him. He just pointed out where the Pritt stick should go.
Like Richard Desmond and his banana, some butler would carry in a Pritt stick on a silver tray on a Monday morning.
You see, you think you're joking, but I can remember Ian arranging little bits of paper like confetti, individual stories and cartoons on sheets of cardboard, which then had to be carried across the room because the pages, even at that point, were actually done on these things called computers, which we had by that point, but just being carried so carefully. And if anyone opened a door or there was a draft or anything, that could be be it. That was an entire page just gone and had to be done again, wasn't it?
Yes, the chief sub said to me this morning that you were in terror of sneezing on a Monday morning.
Mm, yeah.
It was a whole page completely
literally
ruined.
Sometimes there would be a moment on press day where Ian said, where's that story gone? And everyone would sort of get down on their hands and knees.
Like, yeah, like a contact lens you've dropped. Yeah.
And which year was this, please?
This was up to...
It began with 2001.
This was in 1905.
I tell you, a lot of people didn't get fired after this.
See, it worked as a system. Yeah. You could see the whole magazine laid out literally on a big table downstairs and get a real idea of what the pages were going to look like.
It was essentially an agrarian... A medieval peasant would have understood
that, yeah.
How...
Yeah. And then we paid a tenth of the profits to the Pope and we knew we were going to get looked after afterwards. It was fine.
Okay, I think we've cleared that one up. Thank you, Stephen. Jenny Lanter writes, she's written in with loads of questions, actually, so I'm just going to pick one or two of the most fun. If Times New Roman was removed from your font library tomorrow, what would you choose to see the magazine published in?
Georgia.
I think Comic Sans.
Comic Sans all the way, yeah.
You know, The Guardian commissioned its own font called Guardian Egyptian when it did the redesign. It's quite
great.
A thing to have a bespoke font of your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you have to get that into... your computers? As in, do you have to...
He's 90 years old. How do you get the font into the machine?
Do you send it to Microsoft? Do you send the drawings of the letters?
Really small and put it in those holes at the
I'm
back.
I'm sorry not to understand this, but I think I'm speaking for all our listeners when I say I do not understand. I'm sure it's fine.
There are things called font sets that you load into that are programs that you run on whatever your desktop processing software is, and you can update it.
We do have a proprietary typeset. The Private Eye logo is a specially designed font that was done just for us by... And again, I'm going to consult the excellent history of Private Eye that I wrote quite a while ago. I cannot remember his name, but a very famous graphic designer in the 1960s who did that for us. There is a full alphabet of it, so we could rename ourselves at any point and still have that. Well, we do occasionally do different logos and things. We've been Private Spy.
I'm very keen on this idea of the... Why is it called Guardian Egyptian? Was there a big head office that lost a lot of money in Egypt? I mean, at what point in the Guardian cycle was this?
It was a pyramid scheme, unfortunately.
There we go.
I genuinely I don't know. I did wonder if it was because Alan Rusbridge notoriously didn't say anything in conference. He was literally at the Sphinx, so maybe someone was making a kind of aside to
him. Joke.
No, I think there is a font called Egyptian, so it might have been an iteration of that.
Ah, right.
I suspect.
I would want something actually specific to us.
Well, let's do that. I've got some potato printing kits at home, and we can
make it happen.
Yeah. Times New Noman.
There it is. She also asks, do you see space in the British media environment for a spiritual rival to the Eye? No.
I've
got to say, I don't see any space for any rivals of any kind. I think it's dangerous to even ask.
I think that's actually Evgeny Lebedev's podcast is a spiritual rival to all news media.
I think actually, you know, our old rival Punch, that title is still going begging, isn't it? And it's moved. It was last owned by Mohammed Al-Fayed, who ran a very unsuccessful rival to us for a while.
And his son, who actually offered me the title.
So we could have been Private Eye Incorporating Punch?
Yes, quite recently.
Really?
Really charming young man. And I thought, blimey, I wasn't very kind to your father when he was alive, so this is very good of you to ring me up. And he said, do you want to buy it? And I said no.
Mm. Why?
The price was too high. I can't go into it. Okay. I mean, for me to consider buying it, it would have had to have been under a quid.
You're right.
Okay.
Okay, one last procedural one. In your last podcast, Kevin Doyle writes, you were talking about the need for journalists to report on court cases to make the public aware of the crooks in their midst. To that end, why doesn't Private Eye have any online archive of its reporting of the many rogues it has exposed over the years? Is it money, time, legal restrictions, or a worry that people won't buy the magazine that stops this happening?
I suppose the general principle is we need to charge for journalism, even if it's journalism in the past, in order to fund current journalism. But I think, Adam, some of the specials are up, aren't they?
A lot of the special reports we've done, from sort of Lockerbie to Foot and Mouth, right through to my one about the phone hacking trial, and a lot of Richard's more recent stuff on Teesside, those are all available from the website as PDFs and can be downloaded. I mean, it would be an enormous thing to put 60 whatever years we're at of back issues digitised and all up there. And I mean, there would be some legal problems with it as well, because not so much recently, but some of those early days, we did have to print apologies for stories and retractions and things. So there would be you would actually have to go, because legally it counts as republishing if you put stuff out online. So there would be some issues with that.
I think it's a very good question. Is we were slightly bemoaning the fact that you don't get local newspapers doing court reporting. I mean, the Telegraph used to do it, I mean, sort of exhaustively, that sort of page 3-4, is just you would get the case, and not just the first day where you got the prosecution's case, you'd get all of it. And that was a huge boon to everyone in terms of, oh, look, someone is being tried. Look, that is going on. And now, as I think that he's trying to say, that doesn't happen. And we can't do that. We can't do local court reporting.
You know, the fact that the Eye doesn't put things on the internet is the origin story of me coming to work here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in some ways. I think the first time I ever spoke to you was I had done a New Statesman story about hot women being employed at sort of as booth babes at video game conventions, and which I had chosen to illustrate with some of these women. And the Eye, probably Adam, actually wrote a story about how intensely hypocritical this was.
I think that was one of Andy's, sorry.
And anyway, I get this call.
I was on holiday.
I get this call put through, and it's someone's, and then the woman's voice says, Ian Hislop is on the phone for you. And obviously I think, oh, what the fuck have I done? It's all over. I see my journalistic career come crashing down. And it was Ian phoning me to say, would you mind? I know we've been very rude about you, but would you mind taking the story down? Because I tweeted about it, being like, I'm in Private Eye. And he was like, we'd like to sell some copies of the magazine. I found this very funny that he had to phone me saying, I've been very rude about you. Would you mind not publicising this to people so I can monetize it?
Because you put up the whole story.
It's one hell of a job I got here. People just don't realise.
Yeah. 90% of your day is ringing people on Twitter who've put up a cartoon. Yeah. Here's just a little bonus ball one from Ian Kippen. Dear sir or madam... I like that.
That's me. Thank you.
Whilst I follow your regular dips into the lives of the Sussexes, I would like to hear your take on why a particular genre of journalists, such as Moron and Tominy, can't leave the Duchess alone. I think the answer to that's pretty simple, is that it just gets clicks.
Yeah, I mean, it's as simple as that.
I met someone recently from a paper which has been very, very over-egging its Sussex coverage, and he said, yeah, it's just staggering how many clicks it gets.
I did like the thing that was in our print magazine, the last issue of this, pointing out that Harry didn't believe the briefings from the press. You know, he feels that a big part of Spare is the fact he feels that the rest of the palace briefs very aggressively and against him, but he didn't believe the briefings about how ill Charles was and came over to see from himself. I thought it was a really good, weird little insight that came across in the last print magazine. Mm. But you're right, one of the questions is that they do clicks, and also everybody involved does also can't stop themselves briefing to the press. Even the Sussexes get people who know them, we know from the court case, to brief the press. So it is, you know, some of the messiness of the drama is because everyone involved wants to get their version of the story on it.
So it's easy. Yeah. I mean, because you don't have to try very hard to get sources or information. And B, the general public is very keen on this, and the number of conversations you have with people who you really thought didn't care massively about the rebranding of the Sussex website. People who've really got lives and friends and hinterlands who are saying, well, it's pretty shocking, isn't it? And I know I'm meant to be shocked. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, is it? Yes, yes, it is. I'm very taken at the moment. This is my current obsession, and readers can tell me which bit. It seems to me an exact parallel for the prodigal son, and we're in act one.
He's off being the swineherd.
Yes, and he's off, which is, you know,
they keep livestock in California. That's it. Do. He's doing the work.
They're chicken. They're not pigs. But he is literally out there. If he returns, act two, the other brother, if you remember, very upset.
Oh my God. Yes, I've been toiling in the fields all day.
I've been perfectly good as number one son. Right. Father welcomes him with open arms. Now, as I remember it, the Bible's fairly quiet on the mother who doesn't get a look in. But if anyone wants to help me out on the rest of this story, please do.
Who's the fatted calf who gets killed? Andrew. That's it.
We're there.
That's it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get a copy of the magazine, we recommend you do. It's really good. As you've heard, all of these people who've written in are keen readers of the magazine, and they're having wonderful lives. So go to private-eye.co.uk, click on subscribe. It's very easy. It's very cheap. It's honestly the price of everything else, very expensive. Private Eye, very cheap. Go and get one now.
Good value.
Good value. And we'll be back again in a fortnight with another one of these. If you would like to write in with a question, we're not going to be doing a postbag special every time, but do send your comment, question, concern, unqualified praise to podcast@private-eye.co.uk. We love hearing from you. They all get read. All right, that's it. See you next time.